Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming to the Sydney Institute tonight, where Kate Legg makes a welcome return after some years. Now, she's well known to many of you. I will introduce her briefly. Kate Legg's covered politics and social affairs in Australia and the United States. She's published two novels, The Unexpected Elements of Love, which was long listed for the Miles Franklin Award, and The Marriage Club. And of course, she's known best to all of us because of her compelling writing in the Weekend Australian magazine, frequently with those long form articles. And tonight, Kate Legg's here on the occasion of the publication of her book, A Cradle Mountain Love Story, Kindred, and a Cradle Mountain Love Story. And she'll be talking about that. And we're calling the topic tonight, Escaping the Rat Race, the Story of Cradle Mountain. Kate Legg, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Years ago, when we were, my husband and I were cheerfully bickering over why on earth I'd put a piece of cheese too small to save back in the fridge, he made a bold prediction. He imagined I would wind up retreating to a corrugated hut in the bush amidst yellowing newspapers, socks around my ankles, a couple of cats and hairs growing out of a facial mole. Of course, he was right, because the older I get, the more this prospect fills me with delight. Melbourne, where I grew up, is growing at a phenomenal, almost unsustainable rate. The traffic is snarled beyond belief, and the ordinary graces of you first are forgotten in the crush of people competing for elbow room. Everyone dreams of escaping the rat race, more so than ever, because the more remote we are from nature in our daily lives, the more disconnected we are from its touch, the more reverently we seek it out. About 70 kilometres from Melbourne, there's a historic redwood plantation at Warburton, which is attracting such crowds that Parks Victoria has built a larger car park for weekend pilgrims flocking to walk amongst these giants. Many of them collect boughs that have fallen from the trees and make nests in the aisles of the forests. Trees are also enjoying a literary resurgence. There was Richard Power's book, The Overstory, which was shortlisted for the Booker last year, and Peter Holben's The Hidden Life of Trees, which is an international bestseller. Bettina Arndt recently told me that she had read three books on trees, so much for men and sex. Forest bathing, a Japanese tradition of immersion in nature to soothe the soul and the mind, has found its way here, and Victoria even has accredited tree forest therapy guides. Walking trails are expanding in national parks as private operators compete for a foothold to build private lodges in these public places. The target demographic is me, women in the 50 to 60 age bracket who are prepared to splurge a little bit of money on a guided walk around capes, along overland trails, through rainforests, relishing a respite from our crowded lives, handheld technology and congested freeways. Tasmania is at the epicentre of this explosion in rat race escapees, with its spectacular World Heritage listed wilderness areas, particularly Cradle Mountain Lake St Clair National Park, which has over 260,000 visitors a year and is an international draw card. I went there to do a bit of escaping myself after the husband of the half-eaten cheese announced that he'd run out of puff. This was a very apt metaphor, since he was always complaining I walk too fast. Even our adult children now have confessed that they were terrified of being lost or left behind in shopping centres or suburban streets. They wanted to put me on a leash. The youngest was the one who took me to Cradle Mountain to distract me from my emotional upheaval as I entered a new phase of life after two decades of being at the centre of a busy domestic menagerie they call family. When we got to the park, I headed out on my own in the late afternoon of a June wintry day and was humbled by a sense of wonder in its forests. Gondwanan vegetation, ancient trees, decaying logs on the forest floor, tapestried in ruffles of orange lichen, grey liverwort and luminous mosses. I followed the snaking curves of the Dove Creek up through Sutton's Forest and onto the shores of Crater Lake. It's got fathomless pool. It's been gouged from the earth by the slow movement of glacial Britain ice over passages of time too long to contemplate. Its steep, smooth cliffs are carpeted in bonsaied myrtle trees and deciduous beech. Above, on the windswept plateau, I found small ponds that have frozen beneath crusts of ice like lustrous pearls, and around them the cushion plants, which look deceptively soft and voluptuous, but in fact are as hard as rock, for it's only by hunkering down in this cold, bitter place that they can endure. My mood echoed the melancholic key of this sculptured landscape. I felt something shift inside of me. I felt a stirring. I felt my imagination unfurling from the tight-fisted fetal position that I had adopted as a holding pattern. The next day I went out again, while the others sat in front of the fire and ate, in a different direction, and came across a replica of a chalet built by Gustav and Kate Weindorfer, who were a pair of adventurers and botanists. The rat race had barely begun when these two stood on the summit of Cradle Mountain in 1910 and sketched aloud a vision for a tourist chalet and a national park open to all. I was struck by their pluck and passion, and when I went home, I read about as much as I could find about them. Initially, I thought I'd write a fictional narrative using a silhouette of their lives to tell a story. But the more I learnt of their enterprise, their scientific endeavours, their fascination with Australian flora and fauna, their prodigious collecting, preserving and describing of native plants and trees, and their far-sighted vision for preserving this wilderness as a park, the more I determined that they deserved to be better known for who they were. My late father was a real historian who'd be absolutely appalled by the idea of his rogue journalist's daughter rummaging through his hallowed turf. So, Dad, if you're listening, there are footnotes. Relax. Gustav was an Austrian bred in Alpine Heights. He came from a country where walking outdoors was a popular pastime. As a boy, he read a lot about Australian anthropologist Alfred Howitt, who was in the search party for Burke and Wills. He devoured the Wide World magazines full of tales of travels through the Amazon River, the Khyber Pass, Tibet, New Guinea. And given his passion for botany, he must have been aware of German naturalist Alexander von Humboldt's siren call, identifying the subtropical forests of the great southern continents as the crucible of botanical diversity. At 26, he got on a boat and sailed to Australia. And when he disembarked in the searing heat of a Fremantle summer and caught his first glimpse of eucalypts, he was utterly bereft. He described them as wretched creatures with rattling leaves. But he came east, roaming widely and studying our flora and fauna, and he soon fell in love with all we have. Acacias, banksias, mountain ash, Red River gums, even the Mallee scrub he found to be far from destitute of charm. His letters to his German-speaking parents in Michelhofen gushed with enthusiasm for everywhere he'd been, often sprinkling new lingo that perplexed them. Was ist ein Billy, they demanded to know. In Melbourne, he met his match. Tasmanian botanist Kate Carl had conquered Tasmania's Mount Roland near Sheffield twice before they met. Her ankle-length skirt and beribboned hat, no obstacle to climbing high. She described the mountain's tug on her heart as that silent outreach of the soul toward eternal beauty in a paper that described its botany and geology that she presented to the Victorian Field Naturalist Club in 1903, and she was the only woman to present a paper that year. The men present commented admiringly on her daring in such rough terrain. Gustav, of course, was in the audience. He was a catch of a man who could recite poetry, sing opera, identify the stipule, pedicels and lobes of the native orchid as finely as he could swing an axe or coax a cup of his beloved coffee from a candle's flame. She was a most unconventional woman. They were kindred spirits, they were soulmates, and they fell in love, and together they awakened Australia's newest arrivals to the grandeur and majesty of our backyard. Indigenous Australians have always had an intimate and intense love of the land, but in the early 20th century, newcomers clung to the coastal veranda. We regarded the bush with foreboding, afraid of venturing too far for fear of getting disoriented and lost or bitten by a venomous snake. Actually, there are police are, I think, still searching tonight for two experienced hikers who've gone missing in Buffalo. But Kate and Gustav felt no trepidation. They relished the peril and the thrall of being in nature's grasp. They had been amongst the first wave of visitors to Mount Buffalo, the second national park to be declared in Australia, travelling with members of the Victorian Field Naturalist Club. It was the first camp in the club's history to include women in a small triumphant rip to the canvas ceiling. Gustav led the camp, and of course Kate was on board. The times suited them. A story often told around the time of Buffalo's opening reveals a turning point in the nation's psyche and our sentiment towards the bush. It involves an adventurer who returned from Buffalo safely and was asked by his daughter on his return whether he'd seen any snakes. "No snakes," he replied, "but I saw glory." Glory and the idea of wonder and the sublime made the landscape less forbidding. It lifted the scales from our eyes and encouraged us to venture into the wild. Across the Pacific, American naturalist John Muir, who was saluted as the founding father of Yosemite National Park, had published a best-selling book, Singing Nature's Praises, and drawing heavily on his hero, Henry Thoreau of Walden fame, who wrote that from forests and wilderness come the bark and tonic that braces mankind. This was the air that Gustav and Kate breathed. Talk of national parks, the restorative benefits of walking for body and soul and mind, and a growing interest in Australian flora and fauna. They honeymooned for 6 weeks on top of Mount Roland in a tent on the plateau, enduring blizzards, rainstorms, mosquitoes, in a state of utter bliss as they collected armfuls of specimens, delighted by finding 5 new Stifelias at the top. They also met a party of picnickers on the plateau one day, which was another sign of a shift in the pulse of a nation heeding the call of the wild. Years later, when they first walked through Cradle Valley together and stood on the mountain's summit, they emboldened each other to embark on a dream that completely absorbed them. The very next day, he stepped out land in the valley beside a forest of myrtle, deciduous beech, celery top pines and king billy pines near a tumbling creek that sang. They call their chalet Waldheim, which is German for forest home. Like most dreamers, they were deaf to the obstacles and hardships that lay ahead, and there were many of them. They were deaf to the naysayers and the doubters, and they were deaf to the people who couldn't fathom what on earth they'd found in this remote, forbidding haunt. Locals understood the value of minerals and timber and possum skins, but scenery and science did not occupy a column in their ledgers. Tasmanians thought of Cradle Mountain as a menacing place. In 1905, a young trapper, Bert Hansen, had become disoriented and froze to death on its slopes with his loyal Kelpie by his side. And there were 2 search parties sent up to find him, but they had to wait till the snow melted before his body could be brought down. Even getting there in the early days was grueling. Gustav built their chalet in the valley, while Kate often returned home on her own in a horse and cart to run the farm at Kindred in the lowlands. And she would often travel alone and once encountered a most ferocious storm that battered the northwest of the state. But her letter to Gustav after she'd arrived safely home just dances with the exhilaration of survival. She tells him how her hands were chafed raw from holding the reins of their horse Jolly, who kept on wanting to bolt every time there was a crack of thunder or lightning. There was giant timbers crashing down across her path. "Any moment I expected a tree on me," she trilled, describing how she'd shepherded a terrified singer salesman down the mountain in her wake. This was very much a joint venture. Not only did Kate bring the bonus of a small inheritance, which enabled them to buy the farm that subsidised the Cradle project, but she worked just as feverishly, bringing provisions back and forth, nails, carbide, flour, powdered milk, vegetables from their garden. She made mattresses out of ticking while he split palings from native King Billy pine. At the centre of the living room, they had this cavernous inglenook fireplace with a wombat rug on the hearth. And this is the place where guests would warm frostbitten toes and dry their wet woolen clothes and shoes and talk into the wee hours of mountain adventures and national parks. There was a sense of books and learning here. Beethoven played on the gramophone. There was the aroma of coffee brewed from hand-ground roasted beans and the smell of homegrown garlic, which they used to flavour bush pork, which is probably wombat. But apparently it tasted like young beef. A local lawyer and bushwalker, Edward Adams, who came across Waldheim after getting lost in the valley on a ramble in 1914, when the chalet had barely opened for business, was spellbound by its beauty. He described himself as being quite undone. Afterwards, he wrote to them, lamenting his return to town and the paperwork of petty conflicts. Like Banjo Patterson's Clark, dreaming of Clancy of the Overflow's freedom, he pined for this idyllic refuge. Cars had just begun to honk and rattle in Hobart streets, kindling a desire for travel. And though there's a thread of discontent with urban growth in the letters of the period, it is barely discernible. The rat race in Tasmania was a picnic beside the gridlock of the M7 motorway in peak hour. Gustav and Kate were carving a path through uncharted territory. There was no road beyond Wilmot, which was the tiny dot of a township 41 kilometres away from Cradle Valley. Guests were carted over a boggy mire called Middlesex Plains in a wagonette that was owned by Wilmot farmer Bob Quayle and his team of horses, with Ginger, probably, at the helm. They crossed streams and rivers, for there were no bridges. The story of Waldheim is veined with rich characters, and Bob Quayle is one of them. He could have stepped forth from the pages of a Dickens novel with his white moustache, portly bulk, and his droll sense of humour. In the rain and sleet and snow, as the guests bumped along in the back of the wagonette and darkness descended, he would keep their spirits from flagging with stories of previous misadventures, horses being bogged in the mud that required a bevy of men and an oxen to remove them. Once a guest asked, pleaded desperately, "Is the track better further on? This is a carpet so far," he'd roar. Mountaineers, explorers and prospectors would always be drawn here, but enticing the rest of us was trickier. Gustav and Kate were deft at fudging the difficulties of getting to their remote eyrie. In an early draft for an advertising brochure, they wisely deleted a reference to the downsides of heavy rainfall that turn harmless creeks into raging torrents only experienced buccaneers can ford safely. Though winters are bleak, they never mentioned the cold, wet feet and waxed lyrically instead of the exhilaration of sliding over a fresh fall of snow or the musical sound of the wooden skis creaking as they broke through the crust. They were masterful at playing down the negatives, and they certainly had me fooled. I knew I would have to climb the summit in order to write about them, so I conned a friend to accompany me. When we met up at Launceston Airport, she was a shaking wreck, absolutely terrified because she'd been reading TripAdvisor with its hair-raising accounts of this steep, precipitous climb, whereas I'd had my head in Gustav's advertorial. "Access to the summit is easy," he'd written. "There is no danger except for those who look for it." So on my hands and knees, crawling over slippery, icy pinnacles of Dolerite, not daring to look down thousands of feet below, I thought I would die. I was wearing lightweight fleeces and high-tech boots, and I still don't know how Kate did it in her cumbersome gear. But physical exertion was part of the experience. Cradle Mountain, this is what they wrote in the brochure, "Cradle Mountain District is not the place for holidaymakers intent on lazing away the days in easy chairs with books and iced drinks. Rather, it is a spot for those whose energetic souls long for a brief respite from the cares of civilization and the daily newspapers and to spend their holiday in the wholesome open air amongst unspoilt nature, virgin territory untouched by human hands. Waldheim was a place where, as Gustav coined it, there is no time and nothing matters." But it was never just about tourism. The one thing that was unique about Kate and Gustav was that their idea of a place for science and scenery. They called Cradle a botanist's El Dorado. and they knew in their bones the significance of the Precambrian dolerite millions of years old, the glacial moraines that stud the valley, and the Gondwanan vegetation, long before the international machinery existed to recognise its World Heritage values. And the most enthusiastic visitors in the early days were scientists, geologists, lepidopterists, entomologists, because this had previously been the preserve of passionate amateurs. And these scientists were setting up inaugural university departments in biology, zoology and botany around Australia. And the CSIRO was in its infancy. So all of these scientists came with blotting paper, nets and jam jars to source specimens for study. Actor Errol Flynn's father, Professor Theodore Thompson Flynn, was a regular guest, fascinated by the reproductive biology of marsupials. He was always keen for specimens of wombats and echidnas. Not only was there coffee, music, books and garlic, here was unrivalled biodiversity of flora and fauna. They remind me in many ways of John and Sunday Reid, who set up Heidi and welcomed those early Australian modernists to their home. Only Gustav and Kate, instead of welcoming painters and artists, they welcomed the nerds. Gustav was also an avid meteorologist who built a weather station in Waldheim's front yard. He would cadge instruments from fellow scientists, or he'd make them out of whatever he had to hand, and he took 30 readings every day, bombarding the Commonwealth Bureau of Meteorology with more information than they knew what to do with. He wondered at whether or not the climate in Tasmania had once been wetter, interested then in using the growth rings of trees to examine past patterns of rainfall, climate and weather. So he was very far ahead of his time. A team of international scientists has only just completed this feat. They've made a 1,700-year chronology of a King Billy pine, precisely for the purpose of learning more about the climate of the past. He wrote prolifically for academic journals and the popular press, and so did she, but because she died earlier, his work is, of course, much more substantial. His forensic account of native fauna includes priceless insights into the mating habits, breeding, sociability and behaviours of wallabies, possums, currawongs and quolls. And this work was recently cited in a 2014 peer-reviewed journal paper, zoology paper on quolls. So his work is still current. Shortly after they went to Cradle, he articulated their belief in jimmying nature's secrets loose in a wilderness where every walk appears to be the contents of a book. And this is his writing. He says, which stimulates innumerable thoughts and pictures. From the rock whose weather-worn surface is covered with mosses and lichens, from the alpine flower gardens where the kangaroo grazes with its young, up to the gnarled and stunted pines and gum trees and the glittering snow fields over which the eagle soars are the leaves of this writing to be seen. The one will read of this book more and the other less, but all of the art of reading rests in this, to analyse and recognise out of the superabundance of appearances and the individual occurrences the eternal law of the whole and the ingenious arrangement of things. The other remarkable thing about Waldheim for me was discovering its role as an outdoor photographic studio for a brilliant crop of wilderness photographers from Launceston who discovered the chalet in 1920. They were Stephen Sperling, Fred Smithies, and my favourite, Florence Perrin. They called Waldheim Liberty Hall. One of their entries in the guest book at Waldheim sums up the joyous mood of their visits. Glorious night last. We got to bed at dot, dot, dot. Coffee was wonderful, brandy even better. The Limburger cheese smelled, the gramophone played, and everything in the forest was lovely. They couldn't believe what they had found, and they came here in all seasons to capture its dramatic, sweeping panoramas, as well as shouldering in to get intimate close-ups of trees in snow or trees in the forest next to the chalet. Their enthusiasm and photography rekindled the push for a national park, which had flagged in the years after Kate's death in 1916 and during the years of the Great War, when he was isolated up there and the subject of suspicion that he was actually spying on sending the secrets back to the Germans. Words, no matter how finely wrought, do not pack the punch and power of pictures that gingered support for Cradle Mountain, just as Carlton Watkins's amazing images of Yosemite brought this landscape to the attention of Congress and the public. Many of the finest pictures are published in Kindred. And of course, Gustav took photographs too, because he could do everything. He had built this ingenious bathhouse at the chalet, where he had hollowed out a log that funneled water into the bathhouse with a cauldron below it so he could heat it for guests to bathe. But he would use this as his darkroom. And in 1929, when he came to the mainland to promote the wonders of Cradle Mountain, he took with him 200 lantern slides. And he would always show the mountain in summer and in winter, because they are two different characters. As I said before, Kate did not live to see Waldheim's influence grow, nor did she live to see the park proclaimed. The day she died in 1916, Gustav wrote, "I have lost my best friend." Then, because he couldn't help himself take the measure of the weather, he added, "Glorious day." But he never found another with Kate's spunk to share his home in the wild. They, as I said before, they could never have conceived of upwards of 260,000 visitors coming through the turnstile, nor could they have imagined the 21st century rat race, where people are almost surgically attached to their phones 24/7. The day I walked here with my girlfriend, she was, before we took off up to the summit, she was fielding calls managing her great aunt Hillary's broken hip, while I was dealing with another domestic crisis. In the early 1900s, escaping from the rat race did not involve helicopters dropping you off at a luxury lodge or puffer jackets. There was no such thing as glamping. Kate and Gustav believed a certain amount of discomfort made the rewards of warmth and food at the end of the day all the richer. I hate to sound like my Presbyterian Scottish grandfather, but how can you appreciate these simple blessings if you expect them on speed dial like Uber Eats? For me, the whole idea of being outdoors is the roughing it, the dirt under your fingernails, the calf-aching weariness after a long walk, the wind ruffling the canopy of the trees, the prospect of a snake or a reptile in your path, even getting caught in a storm without an umbrella or a roof overhead makes you feel alive. I sometimes think the very notion of escaping from the rat race is as quaint as ankle-length skirts and beribboned hats. Since the days of the early shepherds, we have all longed for Arcadia. And this yearning for a simpler existence, of course, was behind the move tree changes and sea changes in the late 1990s, seeking tranquility. With daily reports of the Earth's fragility, I sometimes feel we are now on a serious quest for survival. The Tasmanian Central Highlands, with its reliable high rainfall, has become the lifeboat for several high flyers who identify as climate change refugees. Recently, someone asked me, what is it about wilderness and nature that speaks to my soul? It's a humbling mix of curiosity and awe, a communion with a powerful force that we are only beginning to unpick. I've seen land for sale near Cradle Mountain, many hectares of old growth forests and feathery sphagnum beds, going for the price of a one-bedroom studio apartment in Paddington. Best of all, there is a corrugated hut with no running water, no loo, and a higgledy stone chimney, and it's got my name written all over it.
So many thanks to Kate Legg. As I said, we've got copies of Kindred, A Cradle Mountain Love Story, for sale after. I'm sure the author would be happy to sign. And so we come to question and discussion. We've got to the top of the hour, so we've got time. Just take us back a bit to Kate and Gustav. Now, Kate dies in 1916, and she comes from Tasmania. I'm not sure whereabouts in Tasmania, but give us her background. And then Gustav, he dies later. I can't remember now what year he dies in, but obviously he's quite fortunate, being a German or Austrian in Australia during the First World War, not to be interned, because so many were, although probably more in New South Wales and per head of population than maybe in some other states, but it was very hard. So just tell us a bit more about Gustav and Kate.
called Kate? Kate was a daughter of a Tasmanian businessman and farmer, but he early on made a business out of servicing the mining towns, taking food and clothing and products. And she once rode with him from Braxham to St Leonard's when she was 14. It was a two-day trip, so that was sort of her stamina. She was, really a very gutsy woman. Her father bought land in Devonport, which is a town on the make, and he also bought land at Kindred, which is this wonderful brown, chocolate-rich volcanic soil where they grow potatoes and oats. And that was where they bought their farm when they first moved down there after they married in 1906. And Gustav, when he arrived in 1901, as I said, he arrived in Fremantle, then he came east to Melbourne and he worked for an honorary clerk with the Austrian consul, but he also worked in a shipping office. He wasn't quite the clerk in Banjo's famous poem, because he got out there and he walked all the time. And that they met, they were both members of the Victorian Field Naturalist Club, which was formed in 1888 and, is still going strong today. And it was full of passionate amateurs. So there were people who were obsessed with pond life, with birds, with every kind of natural science you can think of. And they met on these rambling walks around heathlands and in the Dandenong Ranges. And that was where they fell in love. And she lived in East Melbourne terraced house, and Gustav would come over in the evenings. Kate played the piano and the flute and the violin, and they would sit there, and Gustav had a beautiful voice, and they fell in love over the piano, according to Alfred Hardy, who was one of the lodgers, long-dead lodgers, and in this house. And they would spend time, preserving and collecting specimens. He was amazing. He also sent lots of seeds over to Europe, eucalypt seeds, wattle seeds and acacia seeds, earth-balled tree ferns, some of which were still growing before the Second World War. So he followed in the footsteps of Baron von Mueller, who was the inaugural director of the Melbourne Botanical Gardens, and von Mueller's assistant, John Luhrmann, was the one who signed Gustav up to the Naturalist Club. And so there was this really rich, these early Europeans in Australia actually, helped us lift the scale from our eyes and the way in which they went out and wrote about the landscape and encouraged us to love it. Because we were so addicted to hardwired to love roses and oaks. He died at the age of 52.
And she dies
at the age of... she died in 1916 and she was 52 when she died, but he was younger than her. He was 10 years younger than her, which is another reason why she was a very plucky woman, taking on a foreigner and someone who was much younger than her. But I don't think he saw her as a sugar mummy. I think they actually did fall in love. I really do. I don't think there was any of that. He wasn't that sort of character.
10 years isn't that much.
Sorry.
Don't walk away from there. Okay. Yes.
Kate, I know bits about the story of him in the First World War, because there was quite a bit of bigotry about Germans in there was all over Australia, but I think Joe Lyons got involved with some academic at Hobart University. He also is a friend of the other chap that was up there, that was the famous actor son.
Theodore Thompson Smith.
So it was quite a collective around the university, but the anti-German feeling was very strong, and he was very isolated and very much...
Under suspicion.
Under suspicion, but also sort of picked on and alienated. Mm. So how did it go from there to the national park or the government protecting it? Tell us a bit about the story of how from there to there happened, because in a sense... He became the hero of something very special after being outlawed as a
woman. And she was sort of forgotten. That was the sad thing. But firstly, just the interest in them. Before the war even began, locals used to open up their letters because, they came, obviously, they were... There was very few post offices up there. There was a day they used to put them in a box nailed to the Daisy Dell tree, and whenever they were delivered to her sister Laura, there'd be grubby fingerprints all over them. So, and during the war, yes, Tasmania I think boasted that it in turn more interns, enemy aliens, than any other state. And you didn't have to do anything. You just had to be under suspicion. It was incredible. There was a geologist called Fritz Nertling who used to visit to Cradle Mountain. And he was German. He'd married a Tasmanian girl. He was a geologist. And he had been attacked. A group of gangs had come to his new Norfolk home and rained it with stones. And there was a court hearing into that assault, and Nutling never returned after lunch to give evidence because he'd been interned. there was never any explanation of what had happened. So during the war, Gustav was isolated, and indeed the Ulverston Club kicked him out because, Tasmanian sons and fathers were dying at the front. And his dog was poisoned with strychnine, which was really devastating because they loved their animals and they were so dependent on them for company up there. And as I said, he was reported, and there was actually an intelligence file opened on him, and officials were sent up there, and they sort of mused that he says he's not spying, and we can only assume that he's working very quietly on his botany in his home. So in 1920, when the Launceston crew arrived, they lit the fuse and rekindled this whole campaign for a park, because they were younger. They were full of enthusiasm, and they were in Launceston, so they could organise a northern branch of the Royal Society, which became the sort of vehicle they used to campaign for the park. And that was how it took off again, because it really had lapsed. It had sort of the signs of stretch marks of a decade wear and tear and all the things that had happened in between. And Gustav died in the valley and was buried in the valley. There's a memorial there to him. But Kate, when she died, she was buried in her family's cemetery at Don. And in fact, it was only when a history student looking for a graduate thesis, her husband stumbled over Kate's grave at Don while he was having a walk and came back and suggested to her that she do a thesis on it, that really that was the first time a lot of this information about her came to light. And they were going to take his body when he died down to bury him with her at Don, but the Launceston crew intervened. and it was really reversed the order of the bearer. The coffin was stopped at Sheffield, and they waited overnight until directions were given, and then they went back up the mountain. And it was the most incredible trip too, because they all got bogged carrying this coffin, and they buried him up there. But it did mean that he got all the glory, and she was forgotten for such a long time. And of course, he would never have gone there if it wasn't for her. They would never have been able to buy the land if it hadn't been for her, and he would never have been able to do it without her support. So that it was very much the two of them together.
Right. So, next question here.
I very much support the view you expressed about the nature of wilderness and what you get from it. And this was the experience that your subjects had when they went to this part of the world. Mm. What is your view about the current raft proposals to build high-quality resorts through a number of areas of Tasmania, resorts that are going to be easily accessible, have easy walks, and people return to have a chef-catered meal and plenty of good pinot? Mm. Is that going to be anything like wilderness or not?
Well, I have to, full disclosure here, I did go on one of these walks recently in Three Capes, but I think there are places where you can do that, but not in World Heritage listed wilderness areas. You know, there's so much wilderness in Tasmania, and you can build those huts alongside the public huts. But I think that the places like Cradle Mountain should really be exempt from that sort of development. I mean, they're talking about, a gondola ferrying guests or visitors across to Dove Lake, where they're going to build this massive viewing centre. And there's also plans to build a private lodge at Lake Rodway. And I just think enough's enough. You can't build these, you can't make them again. And every time you encroach upon them, you destroy a little bit of that habitat that's so necessary for the forests.
But given the world is now looking to these places and this demand for this is so great, isn't it likely that Tasmania will be gobbled up, a lot of it, by this sort of process?
Well,
the next generation.
I hope not, Jim. They're mobilising there. There's a real tipping point. And when I was writing, the book stands completely separate from the current debate, partly because I had my head buried so deep in the early 20th century. I was starting to sign letters and documents 1917. And It was really only when I came up for air that I listened and heard the sort of furor of discussion, and I had to think long and hard about what they would do and my feel what they would think about this. And my feeling is that because they were scientists, they were about science and scenery, and if it came down to the line, I think they would err on the side of science, and they would be really concerned by the science of climate change. They'd be really concerned about the loss of biodiversity around the world, and they'd be really concerned about the disappearance of large tracts of unhindered wilderness. And I think they would want us to be really hyper-vigilant of what happens in that park. I mean, you can't know how they would feel, and there is this argument that was really, I think, before I've dug out a lot of the material on the science that went on there, and some earlier historians who wrote about them have described Gustav as a tourism booster. Well, he wasn't a tourism booster. I mean, the tourism was just a side.
But there's probably somewhere in the middle. There's probably somewhere in the middle, is it? I mean, how many people are going to turn up to get a bit of your cheese stuck away in the fridge? I mean, you reckon that'll appeal much?
No, that appeals to no one. That's why it's just my little, my delightful trait. But what you said about the walking and having to experience it and to move slowly through those landscapes, and the whole definition of wilderness is a place that's remote from mechanical access. So it's just ludicrous, really, to fly people in. And, of course, not everyone's going to be there, but we don't all expect to climb the summit of Everest, do we? We don't want them to put a gondola up there so that we can all get up and take photographs. And I just think there has to be really careful management, and it is at this tipping point, and this is the debate they're having in Tasmania, because Will Hodgman, who used to, wanted to log a lot of these forests, has now discovered that they can be a cash cow. And so he's, very keen on doing all he can to promote them. And when I went on this Three Capes walk, they had a launch for it afterwards. It's run by the Tasmanian Walking Company, which has been bought by former airline executives who've listened and know exactly how this outdoors market is going to grow. And I spoke to one of the men in suits afterwards, and it was to launch their walk, and I asked him what other places they had in their sights, and he said Lake Rodway, and I said, Lake Rodway? Because, of course, he wouldn't have known who Leonard Rodway was. Leonard Rodway was an early botanist who came up there often to visit the Weindorfers, and he wrote the compendium that was their Bible, was on Tasmanian botany. I asked him a couple of times, Lake Rodway, Lake Rodway. Yes, Lake Rodway. I realised then that I had stepped over a line and I had become personally attached to this place. And I made my goodbyes very hurriedly and went out of IXL Henry Jones Hotel and stood on the docks and howled, utterly bereft for them, because I just felt this was a real intrusion, and they don't need another lodge at Lake Rodway. They can have lodges around the perimeter of the park, because that's part of the beauty of it, is this slow walk in and this acclimatisation to these extraordinary vegetation and the glacial lakes and the animal life, hearing it rustle and as you walk in. So,
Bettina.
Kate, I was just wondering about their relationship between Gustav and Kate. The whole question of, it seems to be very egalitarian, and that she's very independent and doing all sorts of things. Perhaps women of that era, it was unusual for them to do that. And is there any discussion around that in their diaries and in their letters to each other?
In their letters, she misses him dreadfully, and I think it was because she felt so head over heels in love with him, because she was a very independent woman, and she'd actually expected never to get married and had gone over to Melbourne with her two other sisters. And, the world moved at the speed of the horse in those days, and so, and she knew that if you walked and you visited Mount Buffalo or wherever, it would take you days and days before you came home. But I think when she was on her own in the house at Kindred and he was up there, because she loved it so much, she always had this melancholy feeling when it was time to go. And she would say, if she didn't hear from him for weeks, that when his letters came, she would sit on the steps and cry and read them over until she learnt them by heart, because that was all that had, their only way of corresponding and communicating with each other. But it was a very unconventional relationship, and that was known around the place. And I only... No children.
Any discussion around that?
No, because she was 42 when they married, so it would have taken a medical miracle, and there weren't any in those days. And And so but they conceived of wartime. That was their child. That was their the forest home was their was the thing that tied them together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no children. It was very sad. And but there was never any talk of having wanted children. I mean, she would often stay with her one sister who was married, who had nieces and nephews, but no children of their own. Mm. It was one of the saddest things for me, apart from the death of Kate. When Gustav died in 1932, of course he had left no will, because he just collapsed while he was trying to start his Indian Scout motorbike in the valley. He was about to take one of his trips to this trip was just around Tasmania, but he had got into the habit of taking an annual trip over to the mainland to visit all of his friends in Melbourne. And so there was no will, and you know the estate was a muddle, and the state trustee just couldn't make head or tail of it and didn't know what to do with these 14 huge pine chests that were full of specimens that they'd collected, they'd probably both collected over decades, in the Cradle Valley and in the Central Highlands, and the state trustee valued them as nil. And no one knows where they ended up, and his sister Rosa wrote a letter to one of his very close friends and said that botany was his child, perhaps even more than Waldheim. So these specimens could have included type specimens, which people regard as the shards of the memory of the mosaic of our planet. You know, so it was a terrible loss, and no one knows what has happened to them. But you never know. Weird things happen. And when I was down in Hobart the other day, this Ron Smith, who was one of his closest friends, Ron lived down in Forth, which was near Kindred, and had often gone on these rambles with Gustav and Kate, and had in fact bought a chalet there. And, you know, if Gustav was coming across the mainland, he'd write a letter to Ron to take out his dinner jacket from the box underneath the second box down underneath the table and hang it on the line to air it. So they had this sort of brotherly romance almost, and it became like a sort of marriage, I think, after Kate died, and he was unable to find anyone else to share wall time with him.
I just want to ask you about this national park thing. There's Yellowstone National Park in the US, and it's vast and it's wilderness and whatever, but they have for so long they've had endless amounts of tourists. Anyone looking at how other national parks manage this stuff for some sort of model that they could get both of what they want.
Well, they're struggling with it too. They are really struggling with it. And the Rangers, there's a Rangers Association there. I mean, Yosemite now gets 4 million visitors a day it must be in summer they get 4 million visitors. But the traffic, the cars lining up on that road that go down, there's no parking, everyone drives in. And there was talk even back when I was in Washington in 1991 of limiting, putting a cap on visitors there. And I think it's something that everyone's trying to deal with and work out a way of both encouraging people in there, because of course that's what they wanted to do, and that's certainly what John Muir wanted to do in Yosemite. You know, he spoke about the fact that, you know, there would be people with shutterbugs and red parasols, and we just had to put up with them because that was all part of making people fall in love with the landscape. And there's always this idea that if you convert people, then they'll champion the cause of the landscape. So it's a tense fault line, and I just don't think that we've really worked out how to manage it, and this is what the current debate is about. And they haven't put any caps on in Yellowstone or Yosemite, but they're certainly talking about it over there, just to make it, just to relieve the congestion.
At art galleries with Uffizi
in
Florence.
You have to book, don't you?
They put caps on those things, only so many allowed in. And we've got here's rock, we're not even allowed to go on there are ways in which you limit and people accept that.
Yes.
Because of why you're doing it.
Yes. So, yeah, and I think that's possibly
if you're forming any groups, you might push that.
Yeah, okay.
Tell me about the geography of all this. I'm not sure where your book launch was done in Tasmania.
At the State Cinema, the oldest theatre in Australia.
In Hobart.
In Hobart.
All right, but as you know, Cradle Mountain is close as what, to Devonport?
Launceston and Devonport. Well, it's in the central Highlands, so it's northwest.
And, of course, Joseph Lyons, our only Tasmanian Prime Minister, came from Devonport. So there doesn't seem to be as much consciousness of that history around, not saying a Cradle Mountain, but around Devonport that you would think. So what's happening in Devonport or Launceston to memorise these two and their achievements as distinct from Hobart?
Well, they used to have a service in the valley every year at Gwisford's grave. But, of course, the people who ran that have got old and they've died and they've stopped doing that now. And I've actually met with them. You know, people in some of these small towns, which are also dying, are trying to reinvent themselves along these feeder routes and to preserve and present our history, you know, because we're notoriously bad at it. And there's there's this tiny Kentish museum in Sheffield which has its very own Weindorfer room. And when I was there, Barbara, who runs the museum, she was still recovering from a visit by Gustav's great-grandnephew, who'd arrived unannounced. And I describe ourselves like the members of a small cult who seek each other out. So she knew she had a captive audience with me, so she regaled me with the story of how he'd arrived there on this day when the rain had been pelting down horizontally, as it often does in the northwest, and the wind had been blowing a gale, and the door blew open, and there stood Edwin Weindorfer in a pair of skin-tight black jeans and a leather jacket. And she said to me, he was that hot, he could have curdled a cup of cream in the fridge. So clearly good looks and dash are in the genes. And, you know, there's still plenty of promotion to do and yeah. preserving of history around this. So I hope that, you know, I'm hoping this book will awaken a wider audience to their extraordinary legacy and, you know, give rise perhaps to some other forms of recognition of what they did.
We once went to a barbecue in Kindred.
I know.
Is there any memorial there to
none at all to them? Not at all. But see, that's one of the things you could do. Their house still exists there. The house, and so does the Kindred, the family mansion. It's been moved from where it was, but it's nearby. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that could take off. Maybe even a wagonette with
well, maybe
horses.
You could buy it instead of this other ramshackle thing. It would better preserve the cheese. I think we're virtually finished. Have I missed anyone? Okay. So just, you write your stuff for the Weekend Australian Magazine. Terrific journalism, but it's essentially fact-based journalism. Mm. I mean, it's non-fiction journalism, and you've now done... Well, you've previously done two novels, and now this non-fiction work. When you started off, you said you thought of doing it as a novel, but I'm a very practical person, I must say, but I don't think it would have worked as a novel.
Mm.
I mean, it seemed to me that some of these things work because they are real. They're not your interpretation of what might be real. So how do you feel about that, and what's your next work? Are you going to back into novels, or, as a thing from your journalism, back into novels, or... continue with non-fiction?
Well, it's just on the fiction versus history angle, because, you know, there was that debate years ago between Inga Glendinnen and Kate Grenville about how much imagination should breathe into these lines in bringing people alive. And I have tried to, I mean, use my imagination, you know, in the writing so that you can... create more of a compelling narrative for people. But you're right, and there are so many fascinating characters in there. I mean, Joe Lyons makes an appearance, of course, because he was in the North, and he helped them on the campaign for a national park, suggested they take this lantern slide roadshow around the state to gee up enthusiasm. Billy Hughes is there. He saw at the Launceston Theatre the slideshow and made them show it a second time when everyone had gone, because he loved it. And you've got these scientists who come to Waldheim, and also the photographers. So there are King O'Malley talked for 2 hours at the Kindred Town Hall at a meeting that was chaired by Gustav about his plan for Commonwealth Bank using post offices and branches throughout the state. And he wore this huge sombrero hat, and I think it was Manning Clark described him as a picaresque character who had more bold ideas than he did ideas of how to execute them. But he was a reformed drunk and used to give these sermons from the balcony of a Queenstown hotel and had everyone in his palms. And there are also great, you know, European characters. Louis Sadowasser, who was again a German who came to Tasmania, and he ran a launch on the Gordon River. And another early, you know, tourist operator who encouraged people down these magnificent rivers to see the landscape. And Johan Lindt in the Dandenongs, who was a photographer and had come here in the late 1890s, and he was a photographer who had a Collins Street studio, but he would go to Vanuatu and all around the Pacific taking photographs, subsidised by his portraits of society sirs and madams. And he opened a place called the Hermitage, which Gustav visited in 1902. So these are the things he drew on, I think, in having the sort of spunk to imagine what he could do on Cradle Summit with a chalet and a national park.
Just final, yeah.
I just want to add a comment about the book. One of the fascinating things about the book are the photographs.
Yes.
And I've just finished a book on Hydra and the Johnsons, George Johnson.
I love that book.
But it's also, the important thing in that book is also the photographs.
That's
which
right.
Which is a collection of photographs that almost disappeared entirely.
Yes. Richard Wallace,
and brought back to life. The guy died quite early, but someone kept the photographs.
Yes.
And they wanted to do something with the photographs, and then someone's written a book about these two writers, the Greek island of Hydra and the photographs.
And Leonard Cohen, don't forget.
Leonard Cohen, it's all there. Yeah. But I mean, and, you know, the Bohemians of the 50s.
Yes.
But photographs are so good too, and you couldn't have done that with a fiction book.
No, that's right. And I didn't.
And people love that stuff.
And I didn't discover the photographs, really. I knew that. I knew that, of course, the main photographers I knew existed. But Gustav's 400, he had 400 prints that were only, negatives that had only turned into prints a year ago because the negatives were being decayed and destroyed in the Hobart archive. So I was really lucky that that was done. And they did a beautiful job, too.
Those things are lost in archives.
I know.
Okay.
Those glass negatives?
Yes, there were lots of glass negatives. I don't think his were glass negatives, but a lot of the early photographs they took were glass negatives, and I had to go and look at those with white gloves, you know, under the microscope, because they haven't all been printed yet, you know, because they're so starved of funds and resources, as you know, in these museums and libraries of ours, and it really reminded me all over again of how valuable they are. Mm-hmm. Such a virtue, really, for public life.
Kate Leake, many thanks.
Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.